also from MudhouseMedia.com. Join Patrick McEnroe as he has conversations with incredible guests on his tennis podcast, Holding Court. Share his love of tennis, the tournaments, events, and news with other professional athletes, artists, Hollywood stars, and CEOs. Exclusively on the Mudhouse Media Network and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Tanya's Table. On this week's episode, I'm speaking with my dear friend and chef, Elizabeth Faulkner. Hello, Elizabeth.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you doing?
I'm doing good.
What are you up?
It's a beautiful day here today.
Is it? It's gorgeous here, too.
Oh, nice.
What are you doing down there in L.A. today? What did you do this morning?
Well, I watched a documentary early on, by a filmmaker friend of mine. And then I got on a call with a bunch of chefs for the D and, Democratic Senate, no, DSCC for the Georgia races.
Oh, great. Okay.
I was going to call for that.
Yeah.
And then I talked to Michelle Nishan for a little bit about Pulse and Wave and some product stuff. And, and I'm just, I don't know. I do a million different things in a day. I got a stationary bike. I'm going to build a bike today for my garage so that there's no excuse when I don't go out on my bike that I can at least do indoors.
Well, I know you do so many different things. That's why I was like, what did you do today, Elizabeth? Because every time I talk, you're doing so many different things. You're so busy. Are you busier?
I keep myself busy because I'm a chef, but I'm used to being a busybody.
Right, exactly. There's always something to do, right? And when you're in a restaurant, there's always something. Yeah, it's a hard groove to get out of. You know, people are like, oh, how's your day off? Did you relax? What'd you do? And I'm just like, not really. Yeah.
Don't know how to do that. Been trained the opposite.
Yeah, exactly.
If I don't do a lot of stuff, I feel like I'm being lazy.
Right, you know? Exactly.
Yeah.
I know everyone's like, you're doing so much, you're so busy. I'm like, no, I mean, what else? What's the alternative?
Exactly.
But we still
managed
to have some fun. What is going on here? I had acupuncture this morning, which was great. It's a great way to start.
Good for you.
Yeah, and recovering a little bit from the weekend or the week of service. Mm-hmm.
Were you crazy busy?
We were really busy the day before Thanksgiving, which is great. Mm-hmm. We sold whole pies and, you know, people were stocking up on sides. A lot of our sides are, you know, good for Thanksgiving. And then,
perfect, yeah.
Yeah, and day after, not so much. Everybody was full. And then Saturday, they were back at it, you know, craving fried chicken, of course. So it's like the story of my life.
Can't get enough poultry right now.
No, right? Exactly. And then, you know, we have a parklet outside and all our lights were stolen. So there's that to deal with.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. It's never ending.
Yeah. It's years.
Yeah.
Never ending.
only five more weeks, I think, right? Is it 5 more weeks? I can't even remember. I think it's, something like that, right? Which is good. But, considering it all, and I think you agree with me. I mean, it's just been an interesting year and a good one for some change, right? Do you think so?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's kind of like, it's in some ways there's so many positives coming out of it because many things were boiling up and needed to surface, and, and certainly a lot of things have come up this year. But it's like human species, we need to deal with some things, and we're doing some things really wrong to the planet and to each other.
Yep, exactly.
And, we need to, you know, and it's like, I would say 2020 has been like this mirror of like, how do we progress into the future? Because we're going to have to look back at some mistakes and learn from, and really learn from them, not just kind of like close your eyes or ignore or pretend it's too busy or something, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's made us have to stop and really think about just, you know, what happens in a day, what can happen in a day.
Yeah. And take our heads out of the sand.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally. And figure out how to, we're going to dance some more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
So funny. I was thinking, like, I've really gotten to know you over the past, like, 4 or 5 years, a lot of it, yeah, dancing at events and cooking at events mm-hmm. and hanging out. And I know you well, but I still, like, there's still so much of your story I don't know, like, in the beginning. Because when I moved to the Bay Area in 2001, I mean, your restaurant was so hot. I remember coming to an event there, meeting you and eating your food. And you were much more pastry-focused and savory. And, you know, you've just really evolved. And now you're not working in restaurants, but you're still keeping so busy and you're working on a documentary. So, I don't know, take me back, like, to, like, little Elizabeth when she graduated from high school. Like, what? Tell me, like, your story, your journey some more. And some of my listeners may not know as well.
Sure. I mean, I grew up in Southern California in the suburbs, not right in the heart of L.A., which I was resentful as a kid about.
Right.
You know, I wanted to be closer to the action.
Yeah.
As kids do. And, you know, I really didn't think about cooking until much later as a profession,
mm-hmm.
just because I had grown up in this sort of Hollywood environment. But I didn't really think I wanted to do that whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went to school. I was going to Pepperdine University, where my dad used to be an art professor.
Mm.
And so I went there for a few years, mm-hmm. A couple of years. And then my second year was two semesters in abroad. So I was in England and then in Germany.
Oh, wow.
And so, of course, we had URL passes back then. And we would just go to, especially in Germany, we could mm-hmm. go to all the other countries on the, we only had 4 days of the school week, so we would be encouraged to travel a lot.
Wow.
And then that's when I really started tasting, like, wow, there's so much, you know, like, I just didn't have a lot of interesting food around me where I grew up.
Mm-hmm.
But I just fully loved, like, having yogurt in Switzerland and mm-hmm. croissants, you know, early in the morning in France. And I remember going to Italy several times and just not having that much money, but being enamored with, like, ordering the cheapest pizza, which was just, like, dough with the Parmesan and the olive oil that's sitting on the table.
Mm-hmm.
And that mm-hmm. was, like, our pizza, you know?
Yeah.
In Pisa. And then, or just getting, like, a cheap bottle of Chianti and some olive oil and bread. And
that's all you needed, like, in your 20s, right? Just carbs and sugar. That's it.
And then even in London, where this was in the 80s, so there wasn't, like, a lot of, there wasn't the food that's there now.
Right, right.
Indian food was the most excellent food there.
Mm.
And then there were all these British and French cheeses. And so
mm-hmm.
that's kind of what my friends and I would just, like, if we were going to splurge, we'd get a bottle of champagne and some French and English cheeses in London. And then, but anyway, so then I came back to California and I just knew I felt like I either needed to go to New York. I was planning on moving to New York, but I kind of just felt like I needed to check out San Francisco
because
mm-hmm. I was born there and I had been there on family trips a few times and I always thought it was so much cooler than LA at the time.
Hmm.
And
yeah.
Just like a lot, you know, it had its own kind of art, crazy avant-garde arty environment,
mm-hmm.
you know, back then
mm-hmm.
coming out way out of the 60s, but it was also, a much more liberal place
mm-hmm.
That wasn't really out yet, but mm-hmm. then when I went up there for a trip in the summertime, and I went to San Francisco Art Institute to check it out, and I decided that's where I really wanted to go to finish college
mm.
and study experimental film.
Mm.
So, well,
hello? Oops, we lost you there, Elizabeth.
That was Whole Kitchen that Chuck Williams had designed, and all these Bay Area luminary chef people and cookbook authors would come in all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of like had this realization that the celebrities in the Bay Area were chefs and culinary people, not mm-hmm. movie stars.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought that was like the most exciting thing. And I just.
Oh.
Time at different restaurants. So I got a taste of stars and Chez Panisse and Beowulf and a restaurant called Eddie Jack's. I remember meeting Bruce Hill a million years ago when he was at a restaurant called Ori Italia, which I just love that crazy name. But anyway, the produce and the influence of food stuff really started affecting my experimental film work. And so my final film in college actually involved having the audience drink espresso from my, I got some thermoses I borrowed from William Pinola, made espresso because I was always into those kind of coffee drinks. Brought it to the theater. So everybody had a, because I figured the audience would be really bored with student films, especially in an avant-garde film school. And so I jacked them up on espresso and then gave them chocolate-covered raspberry sorbet bonbons that I had made.
Wow.
And that was sort of how I wanted to jazz up my experience, because I wanted the film to be much more of an experience than just a visual experience, but like a interactive kind of thing. So what was really happening was that I just really was falling in love with this sort of food revolution. And then I after William Sonoma, I really wanted to, I had done some, you know, I was a server in a catering company, you know, just trying to make money, getting some different gigs and stuff. But I found myself always kind of going to the kitchen to watch their choreography of how people would move around each other and just really loving that theater of it. And
yeah, it's a dance, right? I mean, you have to be able to dance in the kitchen and the restaurant.
You have to be able to dance
together. Yep.
And so I tried to get a job in the kitchen. I said I would do anything, and I ended up getting a server job because they were like, well, you will be fine as a server. Maybe someday you'll get in the kitchen. So I worked at the Nika Hotel in the French restaurant for a second, but I really didn't like the server uniform. And and then I somebody told me about the Café Claude was hiring a nighttime plater / dishwasher. And this friend of mine was like, you should just go do that yourself. Cause I was like obsessed with cooking at home. And so I really just kind of went over and said, you know, I was working at a film production company as a PA in the office. And then I, took on this little nighttime job at Café Claude. Well, and that just changed. That was the game changer for me. Cause I just, I really thought, okay, this is what I want to do. And I just love the insanity of the organized chaos. And that place was super cool. You know, this was like before Starbucks, before.
Yeah, no, it was very European on that alley, right? That little alley. I remember that
like
spot.
A dink bar. French waiters. You know, we all drove motorcycles, smoked cigarettes. Crazy, goofy.
Right.
And then I started staging with, I went to stage at Moss's and I staged at Cypress Club, met Mary Check, who ended up being a mentor of mine, and then she was a great pastry chef at Cypress Club at the time. And then, but I ended up getting a job at Moss's, which was, Moss's was just like one, you know, that and Fleur de Lis were like the two best.
They were like the French Laundry in the 90s, right? Was that 90s?
Yeah. So, and Julian Serrano was the executive chef, and this woman Alicia Toyoka, who had worked at Stanford Corp. She was such a great pastry chef. She was so disciplined and focused. And
wow, where did she end up?
You know, that was an era too where pastry chefs weren't really getting their names on the menu.
Right,
always just the executive chef getting all the credit. And I learned so much from her. I worked there for a year, just over a year, and then I met Tracy Desjardins at Elka, and loved their food, but thought somebody should do better with their desserts. And here I'd only been at Moss's for a year, but I walked in and said, I'm doing this job, by the way. I love you guys' food, but I don't love your desserts and I want them to be better. I don't have a ton of experience, but I know I can do better than that.
Wow. And, that's awesome.
And Tracy and Elka were like, okay, girl, bring it.
Wow.
I worked for Tracy for 4 years all in all, because then I went with her to open up Rubicon.
Okay. Wow.
You know, that cool restaurant.
Yeah, I remember those years. I remember she was starting to get press then. I ran into her at a Women Chef and Restaurateurs conference in New York, And, you know, I was like, oh, my God, it's Tracy Desjardins, you know. Yeah. You know Tracy, she's so reserved and kind of shy, and she was just like, okay.
I know. But she was, I mean, she was on fire because she got the the James Beard Award that year for Rising Star Chef at 28 years old. But that's, you know, we were like in our late 20s. And
yeah, it's amazing.
Kicking some butt out there.
I know. And, I wish I had come to the Bay Area around that time. I just wasn't quite ready to leave New York and, you know, didn't know that many people. But it was really a great time for women chefs.
Especially in the in California.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there was Nancy Oakes was doing, like, she was becoming such a big star of San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
And you had Barbara Trop and Joyce Goldstein and Susan and Mary Sue down here in L.A. And
Suzanne Goins kind of coming up, right?
Yeah, Suzanne and a whole bunch of people had worked at Chez Panisse in those years. But so I always, like, you know, in those were very influential. All those people were influential on me. I remember when we had our first WCR conference at Elfa and at the hotel. And all these people came in to cook, you know, Ann Rosenzweig and...
Lobster
Emily Lucchetti were there, Gil Gander. I mean, I was their pastry chef. So, like, you know, I remember Elka was after some crazy all-night limo party, driving around. Can you imagine? that was just like, it's wow, hilarious. This is so much fun. And,
and it's going to be like this forever.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the next morning, I remember she told me I had to, you know, have brunch. All the brunch stuff ready for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And I just remember Emily and Gail Gann, these great pastry chefs, all came over to my table where I had huckleberry, Meyer lemon scones, and blood orange sorbet. I just had made stuff that I knew people would have hangovers. So they were all just like, wow, these scones are really good. Then I was like, okay, well.
Nice. Nice confidence booster there.
Totally. Yeah.
Wow.
But then from Rubicon, I went and opened up my first place because, you know, two chefs would move on and open up restaurants. And I just didn't want to, I wanted to do my own thing. And, you know, I opened Citizen Cake in 1997.
Wow.
But there really wasn't this concept of having this coffee, like, you know, like my original business partner roasted coffee on premise. So we had... a wood-fired oven for breads and pizza. And then we made all these crazy, cool, inventive pastries because we'd come out of fine dining and plated desserts. And so my sous chef, her name was Sarah Cameron back then, but she and I had worked together for already a few years at Rubicon. And we had to really educate ourselves on how to keep things alive in a pastry display case.
Because
they try to suck the life out of whatever you just made.
I remember your displays, though, just being amazing. That restaurant was just beautiful.
Yeah, so no, I don't know if you know this, Tanya, but our first Citizen Cake was over on 14th and Folsom.
Oh, right. And then, I heard that, but I came, you know, after you had already moved to the second location. Mm-hmm. That's right.
Yeah, so then we had the one over in Hayes Valley for, you know, starting in 2000.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had to move it after 10 years because our lease just became way too expensive, in that area, which was kind of crazy because Hayes Valley, when we first moved there, Jardiniere Tracy was down the street. But it wasn't the Hayes Valley that it morphed into with Michael Kors and.
Right. With all the tech money coming.
Fancy shops and stuff, you know? So like when we first moved there, it was still kind of a rough area.
Yeah,
but what I loved about it was that we had already come up with this name, Citizen Cake, and I wanted it to be a full restaurant and bar and pastry. And so it was perfect next to City Hall and the ballet.
Yeah, I mean, what a great name.
Houses.
Great concept. And now knowing you're fully knowing your film background, it just makes perfect sense. I mean, it's great.
Right. I had to pull something from, because I had always come up with all these fun titles for my dessert. Over the years, and would sometimes pull film references into them or music. You know, because we all have grown up with dominating French cuisine, where like there are classic cakes from, you know, basically the Victorian era. And, you know, I always thought, why do we have to be stuck in that? I'm not going to make the same cake forever and ever. And I also never believed in Art Deco wedding cake. I appreciate and respect all the past, but I was like, but we are in a modern era. So I think that our stuff should look like today, not, you know, not just the painted ladies' houses on the street.
Right.
San Francisco.
Right. Exactly.
But it was a fun time. We did. I did a lot of crazy, fun, inventive cake stuff that, I think inspired a lot of other chefs, pastry chefs and chefs later to really remodel a lot of stuff on the plate.
Yeah, do you think, I mean, you took so many risks because you had an untraditional background, probably?
I did, because my dad's an abstract painter, too, and so the being around art my whole life and going to museums and galleries for 100% had it. I've had a what I think is a very positive effect on my life. It's a language that I like maybe speak better than words. I really understand the process of painting and drawing and building layers. So that's really had an effect in the way I architecturally build food too.
Interesting. It's good.
Not just the outside of the cake or whatever, but that how you walk through memories and maybe new emotions and stuff in taking a bite. How you play things, but how you take a bite through things too. You know.
Wow.
Yeah, so now I'm back in L.A. and just moved here. I decided to move back closer to my parents right after this pandemic started.
That's a
and
good thing.
And I also thought was kind of missing the produce out here a lot and the weather. And I love the East Coast so much, too. I miss traveling and going to other places. I mean, I like a lot of other places in the country and in the world, but I think I really miss that feeling of getting off a plane and just embracing something new, seeing people from all over the place, and talking with different people.
I know. I was talking
not
about
one area.
Yeah, I was talking about that with a friend last night who she's just really restless and has the travel bug. And I know it's just like those. We're fortunate that we have had those perspectives, because I think, you know, they're just key to understanding people, you know, and cultures and how things work and how, you know, just to have different perspective of East Coast versus West Coast in terms of, you know, how the weather wears you down in a very different way in the East Coast. But, and, but the living spaces can be tighter. So there's just like, you know, it affects people, how they are in the world.
Yeah, it's just, you know, it's, and I think you just learn something from being in those different places. Like, you know, sometimes now that I'm out here, I'm like, well, shoot, now I miss Wellfleet oysters from.
Oh, I love Wellfleet oysters. Yes.
Scallops is like not, you know, like you gotta I need to be much more excited that it's Dungeness crab season instead of being nostalgic about scallops now.
Exactly. Oh my God! Yeah, you just gave me an idea. Now I'm just now I want Dungeness crab, Elizabeth. Why did you say that? I had some last weekend. Dusky and I went to fish in Sausalito. It's amazing.
Oh,
got to get back there.
Yeah, but you know what else I like about? I was thinking about this morning. The East Coast. It's, you know, like I lived there for 8 years. So,
were you in New York for 8 years?
I did.
Wow, that went by fast, I feel like. I feel like you just moved there.
I know, sometimes it's just funny how that is. But I was thinking about how people on the East Coast, I feel like have always kind of given people nicknames.
Yeah.
And that, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
it's not
totally
something that we really do on the West Coast.
Oh, that's so funny. That's true. Right.
And then I started thinking about it. I'm like, actually some of my friends out there have always given me nicknames, like just made up nicknames.
Yeah.
And I was thinking how cute that is. And like, I wonder why that's kind of a different thing in the South or the East Coast.
Yeah.
You know?
It reminds me of, I had a friend who was a resident assistant for 3 years in college. We were roommates 1 year, or I think she, no, for 2 years. So her first year as an assistant, she memorized all of her residents' names before she, you know, before the semester, before they arrived, and then they all, like, showed up and corrected her with their nicknames. She was like, hi, Julie. She's like, I'm Cricket. Hi, Sue. I'm, you know, Bunny or something, like, you know, I can't even remember the names. But
yeah,
she was just like, okay, well, that defeated that purpose. But, yeah, it's funny. I hadn't thought about that till you pointed it out.
And I think, like, I used to talk about when I was on the East Coast, I felt like every time I was talking about food and doing cooking classes or demonstrations or whatever, I would talk about how wonderful it was to be in the East Coast, where if it was freezing cold outside and I had to be a make or be a judge of the Cassoulet Wars, thank God it was in freezing cold winter of New York, because it's just so much better to have Cassoulet in that environment instead of, you know, California is like doing Cassoulet doesn't really even make sense. It doesn't, you know, like it's not
right.
That cold.
And right.
It's not as
maybe in gratifying. Tahoe, maybe in Tahoe or something.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then, like, I remember in San Francisco, it'd be like, you know, the most amazing tomatoes in the world besides Italy or Greece.
Yeah.
And I would buy all these tomatoes and I'd be thinking, oh, I'm going to make, you know, something refreshing like gazpacho or a tomato salad. And then mm-hmm. if the fog would roll in and you're like, or I'm going to make a bisque or, you know, Portuguese stew or something. Because the weather would change so much in that short amount of time.
Yeah. So when we can travel more freely, what's high on your list?
You know, I was supposed to go to India this November with Manit. Who's a friend of mine. And she was going to help cater a wedding. Somebody in her family was getting married, or maybe her husband's family. And she was going to do some catering around an Indian wedding. And I thought, oh my God, that's the kind of to India I want to do that.
Yeah.
Help cook, you know, that would be amazing.
Yeah.
And I'm just enamored with so much food in Asia that I feel like I'm just barely, you know, I went to China last year and I started learning more about different kinds of Chinese cuisine in the provinces. And I just picked up so much more information, yes, as one does when they actually go to the place. And so I can only imagine how spectacular it would be to go to India with somebody who's from there.
Oh my God.
And
yeah.
Learn more about the food.
Yeah.
And I went to Thailand in the same trip last year, and I really think that, like, going to Vietnam and Cambodia, and I mean, I would do Thailand again in a heartbeat, because you went there too.
No, I didn't make it to Thailand. I would love to go.
Oh, you didn't? That's right. Yeah.
Yeah, I would love to go.
But, oh, man, the food is, it's just so exciting. And the people are so nice there.
Just
a whole different experience.
Yeah, it's just so wonderful to hear and to know that. I mean, it's just, we, you know, I think when people think of places and traveling, they don't think about, well, you're not just going there to see things, but you should kind of get to know the people and their way of life.
Yeah.
And that's part of the experience.
Yeah, and I would love to go to Africa too. I've been talking about that with Red, you know, the fundraiser for AIDS.
Oh, okay.
And how they go to Africa a lot for their work and stuff. But, just, you know, that's such a big trip, and I don't really have the money for that kind of trip, but I would love to go, you know, to go see what they're doing there. But also just to, because I just, this seems like such a faraway land to me, too. And I know how many different kinds, I've been doing a lot of studying in the last, well, last year, I spent a lot of time studying different cuisines in all different continents, including Africa. And, you know, same thing. I would just like to get to know some different people in different parts of Africa, because it's just huge, and all the different kinds of food have had so many different influences on the world, more than people here recognize.
Yeah, I mean, so much variety. I mean, from just like north to south to east to west, you know, I mean, the cuisines are so different and cultures are so different. Well, you know, I'm supposed to be doing a culinary safari to Tanzania, and we've pushed it back to, we're going to go in 2021 now to 2022, you know, hopefully, fingers crossed. So, you know, sous chef,
That's very cool. I would love to do that.
Let's discuss.
I do get to go to Sicily next year, actually.
Ooh.
And I've been to Italy, but I've never been that far south into that region. And I already know that I'm going to love the food stuff there too.
That's, yeah. You know, let me know when that is. Of, what are you doing there?
That's like next September. Mm-hmm. I'm just going with a group. Same thing, leading a group of people who pay for the ticket to go have a culinary journey with me in Sicily.
Wow, that sounds fun.
I know. And it's all about going to different wineries because it's such a great wine region and trying some everything from street food to Michelin star food and, of course, all the citrus that, you know, is so specifically from that area. They have so much citrus fruits and for celebration, citrus fruits.
Yeah. Your dog really wants to be a part of this conversation.
I know, I keep moving around.
She's like, nope. It's all about me.
But there's so many cool places in the world, you know? Yeah. It's like, I hope I can get to more places. That's all.
I know. Me too. We will. We'll get back there.
Yeah.
Do you like this new sort of this segment of your career where you're doing a bunch of different things as opposed to, you know, being in a restaurant and have to focus on service and training people?
I think this is a needed. A necessary unexpected time of change in the restaurant industry.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it was coming.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm, you know, personally, I've been cooking for 30 years. 25 of those were in restaurants.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have an urgent sense of like, I need to get back into a restaurant as a full-time, you know, operator or something.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
I managed for the last 5 years to still be in restaurants all the time. It's a very comfortable place for me to walk into no matter where it is in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of always know, even if it's in China, like I know that I'm going to find something that looks like a sheet pan or something to cook in
mm-hmm.
or even if I don't know the ingredients, you know, I can use my Google Translate and ask about it.
Mm-hmm.
So I just love that participation in the kitchen with people, even if we don't speak the same language, and taste things together. So I feel like what's really more important for me to do right now is like this documentary that we've been working on for a couple months now.
Tell me more about that. What's the timing?
Well, it's called Sorry We're Closed.
Mm-hmm.
And it looks like, we just shot, I think, the sort of, we needed this counter part to show what it feels like in this period of time that we've had quarantine. So we basically shot some stuff of myself sort of at home, panic cooking and making bread and time lapse and so something to intersperse with all the amazing interviews we had with chefs, including yourself and people in LA, chefs in LA, chefs in Northern California, chefs in New York and New Jersey, and then some conversations with chefs on virtually in different states while so much was going on. So like Black Lives Matter happened while we were in the middle of shooting just right when we started the whole thing. We waited until we were sort of allowed to fly, travel a little bit, you know, before we, I think early June is when we started filming different chefs. And so we captured some footage. I think that's pretty great because we've got cities really where there's like no traffic, you know, being in Times Square with nobody but like an Elmo.
That's amazing.
You know, and the theater's all shut down and then, talking to all the chefs and how they have been trying to do different things, change their hours, having to, every day is different.
Mm-hmm.
And and seeing some people be, you know, like we were talking about at the beginning, very busybody, trying to still make things happen, even though they're not really profiting. And some people profiting, some people actually doing really well. Maybe their business is more set up for to go.
Right. Like a lot of my friends would work. Yeah, pizza restaurants, you know, they're doing all right because that's just perfect. Yeah.
Yeah, and then some people, you know, have already gone through personal crisis in the restaurant world before, or personal health crisis because of not having taken care of themselves well enough. And how this is, you know, so some people, it's very, it's so fascinating because some people have been through some crazy times and then they seem to handle this period of time maybe better. It's just interesting. I think there's a lot of different reactions to it, but there is a common thread. And anyway, so I think it's going to be a really cool film. It's definitely.
When do you expect to be completed?
We couldn't finish it because we needed to see what happened after the election. You know, we kind of needed to see how this it has evolved without it being just like constant news footage.
Yeah.
But. So I think we're getting close. That's all I'm going to say about that.
Okay.
It's a documentary, and it's, when it's done, it's done. I don't, you know, it's not like I have a ton of experience.
Yeah.
Working back in this side of the film business, but
so it won't be a lot of editing. You mean it's just going to be pretty?
No, there is a lot of editing. We've already seen a couple passes, but I think we need this extra stuff to put into it. So, and well, I want it to be, you know, I just want it to be good.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
And where will we be able to watch it?
Well, I think that's the next phase of it is once we get some solid sizzle on it, then we'll be able to talk to distribution channels. And hopefully we'll get to see it on one of our, something like Netflix or whatever.
Yeah.
Hopefully. Yeah.
Awesome.
Hopefully.
Yeah. Yeah. I have a feeling. That'll be cool.
And then I'm just also thinking about like how to use my background in the art and film and my love for performance and interactive art and food together. I think that's kind of where my real true calling is. Not unlike where I came from with Citizen Cake and stuff. I mean, my stuff was so avant-garde for even our food world, even though everything... When I say avant-garde, it wasn't like it was so shocking that you couldn't eat it. It was never like that.
right.
It was always delicious.
Yeah, no, you're like the way you decorate it was very unique. It was in the way you, finish things and package.
Yeah.
It's great.
I mean, for people who don't know anything about it, I would say like you could describe my avant-garde cake as like some Frank Gehry building might look a little bit like some of the things I did. I would do like tempered chocolate pieces and have them in shards and waves and big curls leaping off of the cake so that it really felt like, you know, it would look like Bill Bauer or something or the Disney Hall thing over here in LA. Something like that where you can imagine steel wrapping around or what's that sculptor's name? So much modern art has had such an effect on my aesthetic in food making.
So how would you bring all that together, the performance piece with the art and food? What are you thinking?
Well, like I have a series of different kind of, have we talked about this, about my installation pieces? I did this Croquembouche Samurai.
I saw like an excerpt or maybe you mentioned it, but I didn't know exactly like,
what it was.
What's the length of that and who gets to experience it? Yeah. Tell me more about it.
Yeah. So, I mean, I have been thinking about some of these things for a while and in some ways, even back in San Francisco, I would do, if we had to do like a HRC event or or an AIDS fundraiser or something, I might show up with chocolate painted models or have two guys, buff guys from my gym wearing like white pants and being topless and pulling 25 pounds of saltwater taffy back and forth.
Oh my goodness.
And getting really sweaty and making an erotic dance out of it.
Well, that's different. Okay.
It was so perfect for, you know, I think you kind of almost as a pastry person, you get, a, you have a license to be a little bit more, well, you think about it. Dessert, people think dessert is sinful, bad for you, you're naughty. All those things, you know, we think about, like, even back in the early 80s, I remember a dessert that was popular back then called Death by Chocolate. And so, like, when you think about all of the, you know, and I've been, when I was just a pastry chef, people would just kind of walk up to me sometimes and say, "You're so evil." And I'm like, gosh, I'm, I don't think of myself that way. But it was because I was a naughty person making dessert and making people fat or whatever. And I'm like, okay, well, that's on you, not me. But, but you know, I think you have this place where you can get really more playful in the world of dessert stuff than you really can in savory food. And so I really exploited that a lot with some of these. Sometimes I would show up at these events that we all do where we have a little plate of food and tell people what it is. And sometimes I didn't want to just do that. I'd have to have a performance piece with it. So in actuality, I've been doing this kind of stuff for a long time. I had a piece in an art gallery one time that was a big, gigantic block of caramelized sugar pieces that I welded together. So it was like, it's just, it was probably about, I'm going to say 4 feet by 4 feet square. And then I had a bed of marshmallow below it that was tied in a knot. And then I made a big chocolate box filled with red Karo raspberry syrup or something that I put a pinhole in, and it slowly dripped into the caramel box onto this white bed of marshmallow below. So it was a very abstract piece, but it was made out of all sugar stuff. And it, you know, but it looked like something that somebody might have put in any museum or gallery, but it was just happened to be, that's my medium at the time. And so just the fact that it was, you'd walk up to it and go, gosh, it smells like candy right here. You know, it wasn't happening. I love the unexpectedness of something in a different place. So I think that like my Crook and Bush Samurai piece was a performance piece I did at Soho House in the Meatpacking District in New York City 2 years ago. And so I built the thing, it was in three acts. So I built the Crook and Bush, which is a tower of cream puffs with dipped in caramelized sugar and with pulled sugar ribbons and bows all over it and stuff. So I built it in front of the audience while we served my hors d'oeuvres and had cocktails. And the audience has no idea what it is. It's just like, you know, they don't even know what this is. Crook and Bush Samurai, and Elizabeth is a chef and she's doing some kind of demo. And then, so then I bring the Crook and Bush over to this little stage behind a wall. What separates me from the audience is a sheet of plexiglass with a shelf, a plexiglass shelf on the inside held up on C-stands. So I've got the Crook and Bush on the stage under spotlight. And I come out in a kind of a schoolgirl, innocent, beginner martial artist, hakama pant, traditional, like, this is part of the martial arts study that I've done. But in samurai, ancient samurai sword fighting, there is one form called iado. And I studied with a guy.
Elizabeth, we lost you for a few minutes.
There?
Yeah, there you are. you studied with someone, you were saying.
Okay, I studied some iado and I studied this junction sword fighting in the, with a trainer in San Francisco, as you know, because you've taken that class. So, but I thought, and I had this idea that I would, sometime in my, really a long time ago, I thought, if you just want to see a Crook and Bush on a stage and somebody comes in with a samurai sword and just dismantles it and flings it towards the audience. And that was just this early vision I had of something that was probably very influenced by David Lynch and Karen Finley, who was a performance artist in the 80s. And so, but here it is, you know, this many years later, and I finally get to build this thing. I put it on the stage. I dress in the, like a kind of a young schoolgirl studying a martial arts space. So I'm walking, I discovered the Crook and Bush, kind of miming it on the stage. And then I just discover a wakizashi sword next to it, which is a shorter sword than what we use in Junction, but a real sword. And so anyway, I pick it up and I kind of, it's really kind of a self-portrait piece because it's Crook croaking bush is my calling. Mm-hmm. The sword fighting is asking me to dismantle the croaking bush, but I don't think that I'm really worthy. But then I sort of take it on. I understand that it's my calling. I go backstage. I come back out in a black cat suit, my hair all spiked up like it normally is, and then put lots of Bowie kind of makeup on and a strobe light and some crazy fun music. And I start flinging the sword at it, smashing the croaking bush and plastering it up against the plexiglass wall so they can fall on that shelf. And so after it's all done, the lights come up and the audience gets to eat the croaking bush that's on the, you know, clean shelf thing.
Oh, and, they get to eat it. That's so good. Okay.
It's a way of serving. So all of these performance installation kind of pieces have food as the driver, but mm-hmm. in a really different context.
Mm-hmm.
So, and some of them are about sustainability. Some of them are about people not even knowing what they're eating, you know, not knowing what ingredients are. And so they're intentional pieces to take you out of your comfort zone and question different things about food or how you should sort of let food happen in your life instead of really thinking about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I would just love to get more opportunities to do some of these pieces because I think they're all really fun. I mean, at the end of it, there's nothing, you know, it's all really tasty.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I could do a sequence of them all together somewhere someday, but hopefully I'll get to do more of these one-offs. That's something I'm going to work on.
Oh, that sounds fun. Yeah. And especially if the audience gets to taste it. because
you never get to go to a museum and go, oh my gosh, I got to eat something in that one gallery.
Right. Or I'm going to just take that piece of art home with me and see how it looks on my wall and then I'll bring it back.
Right.
You know, there's no interaction like that. So I like it. It's cool.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the evolution of your career is so interesting. And it seems like you are like at this place now where it's more about you. It's more of an extension of like you, like you said, all of you, all the dimensions of you, not just, you know, singular, you're a pastry chef, because you're so much more than that. But now you're able to just really find a place to express it. Is that right?
Yeah, and I think it's just part of my generation or upbringing, and maybe learning about all these avant-garde artists over many years.
Mm-hmm.
I love that I, you know, started out in pastry, even though it really wasn't my intention. I just sort of found that I was pretty good at it. Like mm-hmm. the science of it and the perfectionist side of it,
mm-hmm.
the organization of it, the discipline of pastry mm-hmm. works really well for my personality.
Mm.
It's also made me a really good savory chef because I never really just wanted to be stuck doing one thing. And in fact, I really resented the way that the pastry chef was treated early on, how it was sort of like, it's just not as respected as it is in other countries.
Right. Exactly. And it was in our country, it was predominantly where the women ended up in the kitchen. So
yeah. And also, like, biases. I don't like the idea that, like, I'm not a pink box. In fact, when I first started to take the only kind of bakery boxes that were available at the time were pink.
Oh,
and
geez.
I just thought, you know what we're going to do? We're going to turn those inside out. The pink's going to be on the inside.
Really? That's great. That's so funny. Yeah. That's great. That's crazy. It doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah. And, you know, there were only doilies. And I was like, somebody's going to make us like a plain piece of silver.
Yeah.
Or black or something that just doesn't scream out, this is a typical bakery.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So, I think I feel like also it's so interesting, the Food Network sometimes and the food television kind of perpetuates that, like, pretty in pink pastry thing when you think mm-hmm. about, like, Cupcake Wars. And,
yep.
And the candy shows where it just seems like everything looks like a, like one of those rainbow lollipops all the time.
Kind of bubble
gummy.
That's
not what I was ever really drawn to. Dessert to me is food making, and it needs to taste like food, not
mm-hmm.
sugar.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I really, you know, I'm not somebody who's ever really, I haven't loved
confetti sprinkles on, especially in a cake. I just don't want to add artificial colors. And so I don't really fit into that model,
mm-hmm.
you know, especially I feel like it's even gotten, I feel like since like the stock market crash, we got even more heavily into sugar on sugar again.
Mm-hmm.
And it was something I was already fighting. And now I think about it and I go, God, I've been fighting that for 30 years.
Mm.
I don't want to fight that anymore. I'm going to do it my way.
Mm-hmm. And you did do it your way, and you are doing it your way. Well, I would love to, you know, spend some time cooking with you again. I get so inspired by your, you know, your drive to just dive into these new cuisines that, you know, you and I talked a little bit about, like, you know, how can you do it with it not feeling like, you know, somebody's going to accuse you of appropriation, but you're so, you're so curious and you've gone to the places and learned them. So it's like, I think people have to open their minds a bit and realize that, you know, like I feel like I get pigeonholed of, you know, of course I cook soul food, but I chose it because it was authentic and I knew that I wanted to build a brand, you know, that elevated it. But there's no reason why, you know, if you're a chef and you're trained, you should be able to cook whatever.
Well, you're also a French-trained chef.
Right, you know? right. And I can cook French food well, and I can cook some Italian food and other cuisines, you know. But I think it's great, and, you know, we should do something up here with you at the museum when I open that concept, because I'm going to have guest chefs.
That would be so cool.
Love for you to do something in your, Asian repertoire. You know, I think it'd be really fun. And then it's the museum. So, I mean, maybe we can do one of your performances installations there.
I didn't even think about that, but that would be cool.
Right?
I would love to do something there.
It's a no-brainer.
Yeah.
Awesome. So, anyways, I don't know when that is going to be. But, you know, with COVID, when we're going to open and what's going to happen. But let's add that to the list for sure.
I would love to just cook with you anyway, too.
Yeah.
Whatever, you know.
Yeah.
Whenever, wherever.
Absolutely. I've had so much fun enjoying you cooking for me, but it'd be really nice to make a plan to cook together. And thank you so much for, you know, taking this time out of your busy day to talk to me. It's always a pleasure.
Always you.
Anything else you want to talk about, or you want you know, people to know about that you're up to before we take off?
You know, it's just, I mean, I feel like our food world is just, there's just so much, it's like another language, it's multiple languages. There's so much to learn from it.
Yeah.
There's so much to learn about how we take care of our food resources,
mm-hmm.
and the people who grow food and take care of animals and whatnot.
I know. Yeah.
And, you know, so like, even though I'm talking about all this creativity and abstract art stuff, I need to know where, I wouldn't just start painting pictures if I didn't know where to paint. You know, I would pick out the paints that I wanted to use. So, you know, as people do, knowing the origin of things, and I respect tradition so much, but I also love, it's just like, I really think about it like I'm trying to learn multiple languages and I want to speak the languages. I may not speak them. I might always have a Southern California girl accent. but I'm genuinely interested in, and I hope that other people are just interested in not staying in one lane necessarily, but, you know, respecting just all of this amazing stuff that's on this one planet, not the next planet over, but just right here.
Yeah.
Right now, and where it's going.
That's great. So much variety. We're so fortunate. I agree with you. Well, thank you, and can keep on doing what you're doing, and I'll see you on the dance floor sometime soon.
I love it. Okay, that's good.
All right.
Thank you, Tanya.
Take care. Talk to you soon.
All right. Talk to you.
Tanya's Table is a Mudhouse Media production. Original music by Coffee Brown. Music is produced by Coffee Brown and Julie Wolf. Tanya's Table podcast is produced by Brand AOK.
Like what you're hearing? Download and subscribe to all of our shows at mudhousemedia.com.